Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, today my three guests are talking about protection, but not necessarily the kind you might be thinking of. David Bedrick wants to help protect our heart and spirit. He takes on Dr. Phil and says there is a better way, and I'll bring him on and introduce him properly in just a moment. Around 12:20, Steve Schwartz will help you protect one of today's most precious commodities, and that's your assigned or physical identity. Did you know Seattle ranks as the number two city in the U.S. for fraud and identity theft? And as more scams surface daily, we have to be ever vigilant to protect our ID. You know, anyone who has been the victim of ID theft knows what an absolute nightmare it is to clear up. So we're going to talk about how you can hopefully avoid that. And we're going to end today's show with Jill Titelman, who wants to help protect your sense of self-identity and your love life. She asks, what happens when you're single, over 50, and still looking for Mr. Right? She'll discuss her debut novel, which is based on many of life's real and very difficult challenges. But first, let me welcome David Bedrock to the show. He is a JD. I don't know what DIPL means, but we'll ask him after this. He's a JD, DIPL, PW. He's spent 8 years on the faculty of the University of Phoenix and taught courses for the U.S. Navy, 3M, the American Society of Training and Development, and many psychological associations. He's an expert in mediation and conflict resolution, and he blogs for Psychology Today. He's also received numerous awards for teaching, employee development, and legal services to the community. David Bedrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure being here.
So you're you have a doctor juris, a juris doctor.
Right.
And you're not a psychologist. I need to make that clear. But you have a BA in psychology, correct?
Right. I studied, actually, I can call myself a psychologist in certain places and not in others, depending on the laws. I'm also an attorney. I did my clinical training through a school called the Process Work Institute, which is an offshoot of the Jung Institute. It's a five-year full-time training program in clinical psychology. It's just more of a European-oriented approach and the diplomat, which is what you get to from there, makes you a teacher of that school, and it's not an official American degree.
Okay. Yeah. So I wanted to just make that clear up front, because sometimes I get emails from people saying, well, you know, what, a doctor of what? And, you know, what does this mean? And your new book is called Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. You open the book saying, psychology needs new blood. Talking Back to Dr. Phil provides just that. So tell me why psychology needs new blood, and why you're talking back to Dr. Phil.
Good question. Let me say one thing about psychology. I think of psychology as practiced in two levels. Psychology is practiced certainly by psychologists, therapists, counselors, social workers. That what we consider professional psychology. I think that needs new blood. But also, psychology is something we all practice. Whenever we self-reflect, why did I say that? Why am I nervous? How come I'm eating this food? How come I'm engaging in this pattern of relationships? Whenever we begin that self-reflection process, we're practicing a kind of psychology. We're trying to think psychologically, and often we diagnose ourselves. I'm anxious, I'm depressed, I'm whatever, undisciplined, etc. So I think of psychology in that broadest way. And the thing that needs new blood is we have the idea that you would get like on a Dr. Phil show. Dr. Phil would say to many folks, what are you thinking if you said I'm doing something that's not working, as it were, right?
Right.
This way of engaging in relationships or food or my body or talk to myself. He might say, is that working for you? What are you thinking? As if I could tell you that that wasn't a good idea, you would get it, and that would stop you from doing the things you're doing. As if you would overcome it as simply as that, as if you would stop smoking because the smoking label says it's hazardous to your health. But that's not much psychology. That's what I call something like common sense advice. It doesn't go very deep. It often makes people feel worse about themselves because it is very, very rarely effective advice.
Yeah, I can see that, because when we watch it, we're just watching that 1 hour, and the real work, I think, begins after the show in most of those cases, right?
That's right. Most of the time it does. Hopefully, we don't know. But nonetheless, so even though people are doing things after the show or before the show, we're getting a teaching. I don't know what Dr. Phil does with his own clients, if he has them, but we're getting a teaching on that show like we get in many shows or many blogs or self-help books. And the teaching is, if you could stop being that way, it would be over. If you could stop being nervous, Vicki, then you wouldn't have to be nervous, right?
Right, right.
You know, if you could stop, just get up and do what you want to do, then you wouldn't be depressed. So that kind of thinking we get educated in on a daily basis, and it's not psychologically deep, and again, it's not helpful.
And you actually raised the question, I mean, right here in the first chapter, it's called Call Me Crazy, Is Psychology Making Us Sick? Elaborate on that a little, if you would.
Sure. I mean, I'm just thinking of something I hadn't talked about before, but I talked to a person recently who said they had an anxiety disorder, and they said they had gone to lots of MDs and psychologists, and some things helped, some things didn't, but more or less this same struggle is there. And I said, well, tell me about this. And then this person began to describe what they've been told about it, not describing their own experiences. This is what it's like for me. And they are telling me what their problem is, in almost like what their doctor told them, in hopes that I can make it go away. But my attitude is, I don't even understand what you're talking about yet. I don't have a feeling for what you're saying. I don't know what your experience is. But yet that person is thinking, can't you make this go away? And I'm thinking, I have no idea whether I can make it go away. I'm not even convinced, Vicki, that the agenda of making it go away is an agenda that's going to help.
So you talk about principles of a love-based psychology. So, and I'd like to look at a couple of those if we can. Principle number 2, for example, a love-based psychology treats things that disturb people about themselves or others as revelations of their deeper nature. And I wanted to look at that one in particular because I'd like to give an example of how you help people, let's say if they have a food obsession, if they, you know, are overweight and they're saying diets don't work for them. So talk to us just a little about the principle itself first that you treat, and you just touched on that. But when you're not treating the ideas that we have about why we're doing it, you're going much deeper than that.
That's right. So if that person with their supposed anxiety, right, I'm saying supposed, not that it's not true, that's their label, right, that they're carrying around. You could say that's their sickness, that's their diagnosis given them by themselves or someone else. If I talk to that person more about their anxiety, I might ask them to show that to me, express that to me. Maybe if they were free, I would say, if you were free and they would show me their anxiety, my hands, you can't see them, are shaking a little bit because I'm mimicking automatically something that someone showed me. Their hands are shaking, and I would say, if you can keep shaking your hands more, and say, well, why? I don't want to be more nervous. I say, I understand, but let's just be nervous as you could possibly be, right?
Right.
And then I'm just saying, using that word to just help them, and then they might start shaking more and more and more, and I say, keep going, almost like I'm turning up the volume higher on this thing that they don't want to have. Not because I want them to have it, but because I want to see it. And then they might start shaking, and their chair might start shaking. And I might say, if you could shake even more, they might stand up. And they might start shaking and going, and they might yell. They might go, damn it, I'm tired of having this person put me down every day.
Right.
And I'm like, now that person's saying they're frightened. True, they have anxiety, true. But what I found that in that energy was a big booming voice that wanted to tell people to back off. You wouldn't logically make that connection between somebody who wants to stand up to somebody and this person's anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But yet in that energy, if you could say now, at the base of that energy was a lot of power and energy that could break through something. That's a really wonderful thing to know about. Now I'm not trying to help them feel calmer. I'm trying to actually help them come out further, if you will.
Right. And this makes sense to me because I've heard from many listeners after we've done shows on what you might call pop psychology and say, you know, that's all well and good, but if you really have, one lady had severe violence in her life and just could not overcome it, for example, You know, and then the common thing that I hear a lot is people are out of control with their eating. And I wonder if we could look at a couple of situations there that you share actually in the book and on your blog.
Sure. And
you talk about we think, oh, we've just got to have more discipline. We've just got to have more control. What's really going on in a couple of those stories there?
I mean, first thing to say is the diet industry is a $60 billion industry. Them's a lot of money, right?
Right, a lot of money.
Yeah. It's a lot of money and a lot of effort, not just financial resources. A lot of effort, a lot of intention, a lot of hope that people are pinning on that for some kind of change that they're hoping to happen with their body and then their feelings about themselves. The data says, and I've read over 200 peer-reviewed studies, the data says 5 to 10% most people are sustainably helped, meaning, and most people can lose weight in a short period of time, right, and gain it back. But I mean sustainably meaning people can lose weight and keep it. So what's going on? So we have an industry that's based on the idea that if you're doing, let's say you're eating something. I had a client tell me that she drank caramel lattes a couple of times a day, and they were, I can't remember what she said, 600 calories, an enormous amount of calories in this particular thing. She said that was the culprit. So she said, help me overcome drinking caramel lattes, basically, right? That's what people basically have that attitude.
Was that me?
Right. Help me overcome. Help me not do this thing. That, right? And one thing we already know is she's probably telling herself a lot in a very fierce, self-critical way. I should stop doing this. Otherwise, she wouldn't have decided that she's going to go spend money on me to get help, right? Because she's already, her method that she's already using, I'm going to beat myself into submission, so to speak, right? Is not working. So I say to her, like I was doing with the anxiety, tell me about caramel lattes. Well, I shouldn't be drinking them. I understand that. But can you tell me what it's like to have one? Here's a glass. Imagine this is one of those. Can you taste it? Oh, I can remember what they're like. What's it like? And she said, oh, I just want them so badly. And I see her hand reach up almost like it wants to grab something. So I take a plastic water bottle, I put it on the table. I said, imagine that's a caramel latte, and you could take that desire you have and wrap your hands around that plastic water bottle with the same gusto you have for the caramel latte. Forget about not wanting it. I'm not asking you to drink one right now. I'm just asking to get to know what it's like. Because, Vicki, what I know is that one part of her saying she shouldn't do it, but something is stronger than the voice that says don't.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't get to know that part that's winning, right?
Right.
Then how am I going to ever make an ally with that? I'm trying to fight a power that's winning. I should get to know that power. I don't even know what it is. If I call it stupid, I'm not going to probably make a connection with it, right?
Right.
So I say, grab it. She grabs it, and I grab it. I say, you can't have it. That's her diet program, right? It's bad for you. It's making you fat, she says to herself. And so I say that to her, and I say, go ahead, keep pulling. So she pulls. She goes, I want it. And I say, you can't have it. And we go back and forth playfully, and then in a moment it becomes serious. And I say, why do you have to have this? And she says, it's my happiness. That's an amazing moment. Now I say to her, tell me about being happy. Tell me about being unhappy. She says, I would love to have gone to school and got an undergraduate degree, but my partner wants me to be home and be a homebody kind of spouse person, and I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't do that, but I would love to have a degree. So now I know something really interesting. If that hand that grabs the latte, that's grabbing her happiness, could grab her degree, which is also a happiness thing, that might be very satisfying for her.
Mm-hmm.
It would be. So she doesn't need to grab her happiness less. She needs to grab her happiness more. If I try to take the latte away without finding that, she will feel like her happiness is being taken away, the psychological experience, right?
Right.
And
right.
That way, I oughtn't win. She should win. She should grab her happiness. Now, I helped her go, you know, talk to her spouse and decide to begin her college process. The latte problem will lose its grip because it's not serving as a proxy, someone said to me the other day, for grabbing her happiness. We could say we replaced it, but with the genuine need. And in this case, the genuine need was to go for things in her life and really grab them and not let go.
And that's actually a recurring theme that popped up in obsessions, which you say are often about unfulfilled needs, deferred needs, unfulfilled dreams. And, you know, I could really relate to the story you had in the book about the lady who went traveled. She went out of the country and would lose, you know, 30, 40 pounds, whatever.
Right.
That
right.
happens to me every time I go on vacation. Everybody else goes, right. I gained weight on vacation. I always lose at least 10 pounds in a week, at least.
Amazing. Right. If we had the time to play on the air, which I'd love to do, but I'll contain given our constraint, I would say to you, tell me what it's like being on vacation, and I would get you into slowly, and it wouldn't take long, minutes, not hours, right, for you to tell me what it feels like to be you on vacation, what it's like in your body, a freedom, a ease. I'd say if we were playing, I'd say, could you walk around my room? Like your non-vacation day, maybe you would walk, I don't know, I'm now imagining something, maybe more robotically somebody might do. And I'd say, walk, show me what it's like to go on vacation in a movement. Maybe you would make a spinning circle. I'm playing, right? I don't know what you would do. And I would say, and then once we got that feeling for what it's really like, we would then start to look at how could that feeling become part of your life? So that it doesn't only have to be literally in going to Europe, right? That's
right.
also great.
Right.
But how can we find that? Because in the story in the book, this person says, I'm finally getting it. Now I'm going to be really disciplined. I'm a couch potato. And now I've done umpteen diets, but now it's going to work. But then I find out that she goes on vacation, nothing to do with all of ideas about being on the couch, et cetera.
Right.
And that works. Yet we're not mining the intelligence behind what really happens. We're assuming that those things are not good or irrelevant or I should stop doing them. But there's, you know, absolute beauty and intelligence in our own systems and what works. Just mining them is not only easy. And it requires one more aspect of what I call a love-based psychology. That is treating people like subjects, not objects. And what I mean by that is an object is somebody I say, you're doing the wrong thing, Vicky. You shouldn't have to go on vacation. You should be able to do it at home, I can
mm-hmm.
say. But I have no idea about you as a subject. That means you have genuine subjective experiences. What's it like being not on vacation? What's it like being on vacation? That means that you're a subject having real experiences that have intelligence built into them.
Well, it's very interesting stuff, David. And the book is called Talking Back to Dr. Phil. And you do talk back to him in this book. You know, I think he does great work. But there are times when, yeah, I agree, we've got to go deeper. I mean, and you do in this book explain how that works in a very simple way. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Final thought. Take your experiences seriously. Don't disavow them, knock them, criticize them so readily. Inside of you are seeds of incredible intelligence, especially in the things that are most difficult. If you do that, you'll begin a relationship with yourself that will more likely make those outer changes than going after the things you don't like about yourself will do.
Right. And the thing I took away throughout this book is, you know, don't buy into popular theories just because they're popular. we're all individuals.
That's right.
And listeners can find out more about you at davidbedrick.com, correct?
Yes, or they could also Google talkingbacktodrphil.com. That's DR, the abbreviation for doctor, so talkingbacktodrphil.com. There they'd see the book, they'd see excerpts of the book, have access to radio interviews, have access to writing I've done for
awesome.
Psychology Today, for The Advocate, and things like that.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David Bedrick, for being with us today. Appreciate it. And the book, again, is called Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Steve Schwartz, who's going to talk to us about protecting our identity. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800 1-800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease? And kidney failure is more than 3 times higher in African Americans. If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one. Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now, you know.
Content is king, and great copywriting creates brand evangelists. So whether you're creating content for your business website, Facebook, Twitter, or mobile device, every word must work for you. On Saturday, May 4th, Vicki St. Clair presents her popular workshop on crafting engaging business content. As an award-winning communications professional for more than 10 years, Vicki consults with Fortune 50 companies. And as a small business owner herself, understands your demands and concerns. She'll share key messaging strategies to help you leverage relationships with your brand's most engaged customers and fans. Contact Vicki to learn more about the May 4th workshop. Call 800-495-7617 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Real people, real life, real radio. Really. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking about identity theft protection in this segment. We're talking with Steve Schwartz. He's frequently cited in the media on such topics as credit monitoring, fraud, cybercrime, online threats and scams, and child identity theft, which is pretty huge. Mr. Schwartz is a strong advocate for consumer education about identity threats and prevention, and is the president of Partner Services at Intersection Incorporated. He also oversees departments at Identity Guard, its Consumer Identity Theft Service. Steve Schwartz, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. You've written this book called Bankrupt at Birth, Why Child ID Theft is on the Rise and How It's Happening Under Parents' Noses, along with Joe Mason, who's also in the identity theft protection business. Tell us why you wrote this book now and why you wrote it. Specifically, I mean, you cover a lot of things in here, but it is about child ID theft for the most part.
It is. A number of years ago, actually not too far ago, probably a couple of years back, the press really started to pick up on this phenomenon of child identity theft. And being in the ID theft business, we had been somewhat aware of it. But as you heard more and more of the stories of kids who turn 18 and go to get a driver's license or get their first credit card or get a job, and they find out that they've been in bankruptcy, or some parent gets threatening letters from a collection agency, we really started to dig into this quite a bit to try and understand it more and understand if it was something that was more than just the media picking up on a few stories. And it turned out that it was. And it's a horrific crime because, you know, as adults, we at least appear to often be in control of those kinds of things. And we have means to go ahead and check on your identity and to know what's going on, but kids don't. Their social security number and their credit history should be clean when they turn 18. And we found out that in many cases that's not true. And so we wanted to write a book to educate the consumers and parents on how this happens and how they can help to keep their children safe.
Right.
And clean, have a clean credit history when they turn of age.
Right, because this, I mean, this is no joke trying to clean this up if somebody's stolen your identity. I mentioned to you, I used to work in the financial world before I well, 14 years ago now, but you know, I just remember people in tears in my office trying to get this cleared up, and it is a nightmare.
It is. We have, as part of our services here, we do recovery services, and our agents for people who have our products, you know, they will spend all the time necessary on a phone with someone, but we listen to those calls, you know, for quality control. You know, you always hear that this is being recorded for quality control. It actually is, and we do listen to make sure that that people are doing the right thing, and people are so thankful that there's someone on the other end to help them through this crime, because it's people don't know where to turn. They don't know what to do. Often, you know, unless there's somebody behind them, law enforcement has a hard time following up on it because they're out there, you know, chasing murderers and drug dealers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this crime is no less invasive to someone than if you came home and your front door was open and somebody had been through your house.
Right, right. And, you know, we broadcast all over the world on the internet, but we broadcast from the station live out through Seattle and the Pacific Northwest. And just in case people are thinking, well, you know, Seattle probably doesn't see much of this. According to the FBI website, it's number 2 on the 10 most risky cities for what they call hijacking. Pretty shocking.
Well, yes and no, in a sense. I mean, Seattle is a very online-centric, you know, very progressive city when it comes to things like that. And people take it for granted, oh, I can just go on a wireless network and do this, or I'll just go onto this website and put my information in. And you know, you need to be careful.
Yeah. So let's start with looking at kids' identity. Why do people steal children's identity?
Because it's clean. They're not supposed to have one, is really what it comes down to, right? So if you're a thief and you want to build up some good credit, and that's often what thieves do. They don't go right out and steal things right away. They'll build up a credit profile so that they can get a really big line of credit, and then they'll go do some damage. So it's easier with someone who has no history at all. You can start fresh. You can create a fake persona with that person's Social Security number, and then you can get the big score. The other side of it is there are people who are, you know, need Social Security numbers in order to get jobs, and they use it. They, you know, again, these things are sold fairly cheaply online, and they can use them for that purpose too.
Mm. So, does a child need a Social Security number at birth?
I guess it would depend upon how you defined need. There actually is no need for a child to have a Social Security number at birth. However, in order for a parent to get a tax deduction. In today's world, and it started, you know, a while back, the SSA has decided, that's the Social Security Administration, has decided that you need to prove that you have a child, and therefore you have to have a Social Security number for that child. And that's, you know, in a sense, how a lot of this got started.
Right, right. There's a short story in the book about taking, I'm not sure if it was you or Joe, the other author here, who took his daughter to the doctor or dentist.
That was me, actually.
Okay. And then your wife is asked, you know, what's your child's Social Security number? And we should always ask why they need that, correct?
Yeah. She actually almost got into a big fight with the receptionist. My daughter was going in for some oral surgery on her mouth. And, you know, she didn't want to give her service. And she said, I have a valid, you know, insurance card here. It doesn't have my Social Security number. It has my medical ID number on it. That's all you need. You don't need your Social Security number. There's no reason for you to have it other than you just are used to asking for it. And at the end of the day, that doctor actually came out and they cleared it all up and it was fine. But we're so preconditioned to just giving it out. And in the medical industry, they're so preconditioned to just asking for it.
Yes. Yeah. I think we've got to be a lot more careful. I know I went in for just a routine test a couple of years ago and they asked, one of the questions they asked me was if I had a will, and that was going in a computer somewhere. I'm like, you don't need to know that.
And not a living will, but a will.
The answer was, well, the computer's asking for it. And I said, well, tell the computer I refuse to answer. So who is perpetrating these crimes mostly? You know, I think that people think there's this sinister gang somewhere, and in some cases that's true, but often it's ordinary people.
Actually, you answer the question. That's exactly what I was going to say. It varies everywhere from organized crime here in the U.S. and abroad, all the way to family members themselves, relatives. There are stories of parents themselves who do it to their children. There's not mm-hmm. much, you know, that anybody can do in those circumstances. But relatives, people that you're familiar with, who know you, who have access potentially to the data and the information. So it's a wide range, wide cast of characters who perpetrates these crimes.
How can we tell if our child has, somebody has used our kid's identity?
There, you know, there are some telltale signs. So your child shouldn't be getting calls from collection agencies, not to state the obvious, right?
That's, right. That's a,
you know, if you're getting offers for credit in the mail in your child's name, that's generally a good sign, especially if they've, you know, if they're very young. As they get a little older, that gets harder because, just giving another example, for instance, as my daughter, when she turned 16 and we started flying a little more, I got her a frequent flyer number, and all of a sudden she was getting some credit card solicitations, mostly from that airline. So I wasn't too worried. But general credit solicitations, that's one. You know, unfortunately, you go to your first visit to the DMV when your kid turns of age to get a license, and they all of a sudden say that, well, you have tickets or you've been in bankruptcy. So, you know, it's things like things that just seem a little odd that shouldn't mm-hmm. be happening to children, especially the smaller children, you know, under who are preteen.
Mm-hmm. You and Joe have different views on kids using social media, computers, cell phones. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I was one of those parents who my children weren't very happy with when it, you know, came to a cell phone. I think both of my children, who are older now, were the last in their classes to have cell phones, and I took a lot of abuse, mostly just from them, for that. But you know, at that point, they weren't driving; they were getting rides back and forth to wherever they needed to be, and I didn't see any reason for them to expose themselves in that way to lots of different things, not just identity theft, but, you know, things happen on social media, the sexting, all of that stuff. I just didn't think it was necessary. And honestly, when we finally gave in, it was because it was more for us than for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that way on the computers too, you know, really like keeping the network locked down at home, having controls on websites that can be visited through the internet, which was an inconvenience for me as well, but it's still something to do for the, you know, protection for the household. But you know, children, especially preteen and early teen, they don't understand or know the dangers that are out there.
Right.
And it's really, really important for parents to be parents and to monitor and control access. I think, you know, things have changed a bit, and you know, allowing some access is fine, but you really have to control and monitor. Having a laptop up in their room where they're on there by themselves at night and you have no idea what's going on, probably just not a good idea.
Right. There's that thin line between teenagers screaming, "You're invading my privacy," and parenting. I mean, it's a difficult situation for parents, really.
Well, I have my personal philosophy is, you know, as a parent, as far as I'm concerned, my teenager has no privacy.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't mean to be so extreme about it, but it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're right. You do have to respect their privacy as they get older, allowing more and more and more. But when it comes to, you know, the online world and social media and all those things, they need some oversight.
Yeah, I agree with you. Under our house, our roof, these are our rules. So we've got tax season coming up a little bit. Let's talk, I mean, not a little bit, a lot.
We're in it.
Let's talk about some of the ways that we can avoid tax scams there, because the numbers were horrific. They were in the billions.
Yeah, tax fraud has become a very, very big topic. You hear stories and read in the paper all the time of people who go to apply for refunds, and the IRS says, "Well, we just sent you one 2 weeks ago." To which the response is generally, "Well, it didn't go to me." That one's, I would say, a little tougher, only because many times your identity has already been stolen,
mm-hmm.
and the tax portion of it is either a telltale sign or the end result of that identity theft. And so you need to be much, much more ahead of it and monitoring your identity sort of on a regular basis. But having said that, there are still ways to, you know, protect yourself. You know, the IRS is not sending you an email asking for personal information. They're just not.
Right. They never send emails, do they?
Yeah. They, you know, you're likely, it's not even a phone call. It's going to be a registered letter to you if you're going to get some sort of question from the IRS. And even if you think that any of those things are from the IRS, don't click, don't give the information over the phone, call the IRS directly yourself, or go to irs.gov on your website, enter the address yourself. And that's the safest way to do things, because that way you can't be spoofed with an address that's not, you know, that's the wrong address in the email that may look like it's from the IRS and it's not.
Right.
You know, like with children, you need to safeguard your Social Security number. You be careful where you give it out. I think for adults it's a little harder, because if you're of a certain age, it's probably all over the place already anyway. But that's no reason to continue to give it out and have it be proliferated even further. Be careful when you're on a wireless network that is not at home, and your home network should always be hidden and protected. So don't do financial transactions in Starbucks on their Wi-Fi.
Right.
You know, turn your Wi-Fi off and use your carrier's cellular network. It's safer. If you must do something on your phone, you know, make sure your computer, basic stuff, make sure your computer antivirus software is up to date, and then you have a complete spectrum. It's not just antivirus. You have the malware, the spam, all that other software that keeps the bad stuff off your computer. Make sure it's up to date. And then you should monitor your credit file, whether it's through a service like Identity Guard,
mm-hmm.
or whether you're going to the annual credit report site that the FTC has. Either way, make sure you keep an eye on it and that nothing funny is happening, and that, you know, by the time it hits your credit report, generally something has happened, but at least you'll know.
Right. It's important to monitor early.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, scams are coming out all the time. And, you know, a lot have come out of Nigeria. I think a lot's been written and said about that. What are some of the latest, a couple of the latest scams that are out there right now?
You know, I don't really think that they've changed all that much. I think one of the things you'll notice about the scams, especially on email, you know, as recently as 3 to 5 years ago, you used to be able to look at an email and it was written like somebody who had no grasp of the English language, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and someone like we're going to go, how could you respond to that? But the thing today is that the emails that are coming out are so well crafted, and the graphics are so good, and the links look real. And that is, I think, when you talk about what's the latest in the scams, I think it's the quality of the scam that is the latest in the scam. So it's much, much harder to tell what's going on. So again, if your bank is sending you an email with a link in it, you know, banks are pretty good that way. They try not to send you links to click on.
Right.
But even if you think it's real, you know, if your bank is, I'll just pick one, Bank of America, don't click on the email. Go to your browser, type in www.bankofamerica.com and start fresh from there.
Right.
Phone calls. Never, ever give information on an outbound phone call, sensitive private information. If you need to give information to anyone, to any agency, to anybody, get their phone number or look it up on the phone on a listing and call them back directly yourself.
Okay.
So this is basic kind of safeguards to think about as you're going through, you know, daily life.
All good information, and there's a lot more on your website. Which website do we want to go to find out more?
You can get more information at www.identityguard.com. Search around. There's FAQs. There's credit information. There's a section on identity theft. We have a resource blog, which has all kinds of articles on different scams, how to protect yourself. Stats on different kinds of identity theft. So, you know, if you want to read up and learn about it, it's all there.
Awesome. Steve Schwartz, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate
your
time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the book is called Bankrupt at Birth, Why Child ID Theft is on the Rise and How It's Happening Under Parents' Noses, with Joe Mason and Steve Schwartz. And I want to just point out that 100% of profits of this book go to Children's Miracle Network Hospitals. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. pause.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to New Pro Supplements, we cover the world of animals. This week it's the third Sunday, and that means it's a Kevin and Kim Sunday. Always entertaining, Kevin McDonald and Kim Miller Medium and Animal Intuitive will be hosting the show for me. They'll have open phone lines for your calls so Kim can help you connect with your animal or human loved ones on this side or the other. Plan to give her a call. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease? If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one.
I was looking in the newspaper and saw an article that said if you have symptoms for kidney disease, you should see your doctor. And I really didn't expect anything because I felt healthy. I didn't worry about my borderline high blood pressure. Turns out, it was silently inflicting kidney disease. When you know, it's almost too late.
Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now, you know.
Content is king, and great copywriting creates brand evangelists. So whether you're creating content for your business website, Facebook, Twitter, or mobile device, every word must work for you. On Saturday, May 4th, Vicki St. Clair presents her popular workshop on crafting engaging business content. As an award-winning communications professional for more than 10 years, Vicki consults with Fortune 50 companies. And as a small business owner herself, understands your demands and concerns. She'll share key messaging strategies to help you leverage relationships with your brand's most engaged customers and fans. Contact Vicki to learn more about the May 4th workshop. Call 800-495-7617 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Outside the box, outside the norm, inside your radio. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we're talking with author. This is her debut novel. Her name is Jill Titelman. And the book is called Saving Gracie. And let me tell you a little bit about Jill. She taught writing and literature at the Sorbonne, the School of Visual Arts, Pratt Institute, the University of Massachusetts, and Simmons College. She's a McDowell Colony Fellow, and her stories have appeared in Chicago Review, Transatlantic Review, Story Quarterly, and River Run. She's also written comic books, documentary films, encyclopedia articles, and travel essays. And I'm going to bring her on. We're going to learn a little bit more about Jill and her new book called Saving Gracie. Jill, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And did I pronounce your name right? Is it Titelman?
Yes, Titelman. Okay. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
All right. So tell us a little bit about this book before we get deeper into it. Just let's have an overview of it. I think a lot of people could relate to it. And it's not a memoir. It is fiction. It was a long time coming. We'll talk about that in a bit. But give us a synopsis of the book, if you would.
Okay. The quick answer is it's a very true-to-life novel. It started out as a memoir, and it turned into fiction, which I can talk about a little bit, you know, in a few minutes. It's a story of a friendship between two very different kinds of women who meet because their kids are in the same preschool, and their lives are, we go on for about 10 years from when the kids, well, the book starts actually before the main character even has a child, but the main focus of the book is really women's friendship, There's single parenting in there. There's divorce in there. There's late dating in there. And there's, unfortunately, also mortality in there. So
I said at the top of the hour, it covers many of life's very difficult challenges. And I think that's true. And there's humor in there, too. And there's some great lines in there. Like, one of them I liked, this made me chuckle for some reason. I don't know if I related to it. But is commitment another name for claustrophobia? And and another line I really liked was from Ruth, who is the protagonist. And she said, I'm pretty sure God didn't expect me to deal with menopause and toilet training at the same time.
Thank you.
So
yes,
I'm going to ask.
A lot of women can relate to the humor. It's very female humor. And then unfortunately, when very, very, very tough things happen and then the humor stays there, but it gets darker.
Right. So I'm going to ask you if you'd read a couple of paragraphs to our listeners.
Okay, so this is from Saving Gracie. And I'm going to just read from the very beginning, and it sets you up for the book. This is the main character. Her name is Ruth. Okay, it's in her voice. It's 1984. I'm sitting on my fire escape, staring down at midnight 2nd Avenue, between 12th and 13th Streets. And the particularly aromatic grass I'm smoking is helping me cope with my latest identity crisis. I'm almost 40. I intended to be a famous writer by now, a straight East Village version of Gertrude Stein, maybe. I should have aimed a little lower, but my privileged adolescence left me with unrealistic expectations. Of course I was supposed to bring home a suitable fiancé to repay my parents' investment, but I needed adventures worth writing about. I hitchhiked to Crete in Henry Miller's footsteps, spent time in Andalusia a la Hemingway, and taught English at the Sorbonne. Then it was time to trade my expatriate identity for that of East Village poet.
Not so dissimilar from your own life. You spent a lot of time teaching writing, a lot of time actually writing. You've worked with, Cosmos Helen Gurley Brown and Jermaine Greer.
Yeah.
You know, you study yoga. The protagonist studies yoga. And you said at one point that when you started writing this, that you thought it would be a memoir. So what changed? At what point did it change, Jill?
Boy, I wish I could tell you at what point. Well, I can't tell you the exact point in the writing because I wrote this book really, I worked on over a very long period of time. And But I would say it started to become more comfortable to, this is the analogy. If you go to a party, say something terrible has happened, like your bathroom sink, your bathroom floods, and it, you know, it's terrible, but it's not that terrible. And by the time you get to the party, you can make a joke out of it, and you can tell a funny story, and everyone is laughing. Well, probably when you tell that story, you're going to exaggerate a little bit, or you're going to
right.
you're just going to make it painted a little bit larger than life. It's the same story, but you know, maybe there wasn't. Maybe the water was only a quarter of an inch, you know, instead of 6 inches
right,
up
right.
your ankles,
right.
you know. So it starts to feel safer to, especially with people you know, to be able to change things around.
And so how much of you is Ruth Cooperman, the protagonist in this?
Well, you know, I would say quite a lot. I would say... well, I'm older than, you know, I'm older now. I mean, I started to write this book, you know, about 10 years ago. And I'm in my 60s. I was in my early 50s mm-hmm. when I started writing this book. And it went through there was a lot of time when I wasn't writing it. And I had to do some growing up during that time to write it. So I guess I can identify now with a Ruth who is about 10 years older than the Ruth that you end up reading about. I mean, I can sort of feel like I've changed even since this book, but that was definitely me.
And the timing was obviously right because you tried to get this published a number of years ago, I read, and it didn't pan out. But after a few rewrites, this is a testament to perseverance and a testament to the fact that writing is really rewriting, which many people just don't get.
Well, yeah, I taught college level writing for many, many years in many places. And that's always news to students, when they come in and they really think you just write it once.
Yes, yeah.
That's when you're in trouble.
Right.
So
what did you learn about yourself when you were writing this on that journey? Because I think even if we're writing, a strict biography, we learn something about ourselves, and you've been able to take some artistic license here. So what did you learn about yourself, Jill?
Well, I learned, I think, that your life, this is something I've always believed in. So in a way, it confirmed something that I taught writing for so long, and I always wrote, but somehow since I've, haven't taught for about 5 years, I've gotten a lot more done, a lot of my own writing done. And I would say that what I learned is what I always taught, which is that any experience in life at all is worth writing about. Mm-hmm. It's the way you write it. And I think that, people think they have nothing to write about. And I think that, there's nothing in this book that hasn't happened to, one out of every 10 people walking by, right? I mean,
right.
in some way. It's, life is sad and life has joy. And that's really what I think the main character, Ruth, I think she has to sort of deal with that. She's not that grounded in the beginning. Even though she's 40, she's, as I just said, she's an East Village poet type.
Right.
She has a job, but she can always skip off and go places when she wants to. She says she's had a privileged adolescence. So, she's spent a lot of time in Europe. She's had, pretty nice life.
And you address that circle of hell that we call online dating.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. That's later on after her first agenda is to have a child. And then it doesn't work out with the father of the child. So then next comes the dating thing.
Many people can relate to. And you're not afraid to talk about sex and the single baby boomer, which I think a lot of people shy away from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing about being, I guess, a boomer, which, some people are calling me the boomer writer or whatever, that, we feel somehow very entitled and like our lives are supposed to be fabulous. And that's the trouble is we can feel like a failure if they're not, which isn't good because no life is a failure. But you sort of expect to spill your truth. That's kind of, I think, what at least my generation, I feel, was about that.
Right.
So, we talk, this is what we talk about. So why not?
Very relatable, very universal. The NPR commentator, Nancy Slonim Aroney, wrote, "This comic tale is so moving and hysterical. I couldn't let go of it. Your book club will bless you for recommending it."
Oh, thanks.
And Kirkus Reviews wrote, "A witty, sharp novel that explores the way age, illness, and parenting drives even the strongest characters toward growth and redemption." A really good read. It reads really smoothly, Jill.
Okay. The name again, I guess.
Thank goodness you kept this going. So my guest is Jill Titelman. The book is called Saving Gracie. And you can find more about it at the website saving-gracie.com.
Saving-gracie.com, yes.
Thank you, Jill, for being with us so
Thanks
much.
So Thanks so much.
A lot.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Bye.
And again, the book is called Saving Gracie by Jill Titelman. saving-gracie.com, the website. And I want to thank each of you for joining us this week. We will be back next week. And if you have any feedback or comments or questions on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. You can also reach me via email at info@conversationslive.com. conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. And that's it for today. We're signing off. Until next week, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Content is king, and great copywriting creates brand evangelists. So whether you're creating content for your business website, Facebook, Twitter, or mobile device, every word must work for you. On Saturday, May 4th, Vicky St. Clair presents her popular workshop on crafting engaging business content. As an award-winning communications professional for more than 10 years, Vicky consults with Fortune 50 companies. And as a small business owner herself, understands your demands and concerns. She'll share key messaging strategies to help you leverage relationships with your brand's most engaged customers and fans. Contact Vicky to learn more about the May 4th workshop. Call 800-495-7617 or email info@conversationslive.net.